Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, where news meets insight and analysis and cuts through the noise. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, we bring you short conversations with leaders, experts and decision makers shaping the world around us. No jargon, no spin, just the facts, the context and the stories that matter. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, as the death toll in the deadly DRC conflict climbs, who will or should be held responsible for the deaths of South African soldiers? While the chief executive officer of Toyota South Africa says foreign brands are killing the local motor industry, is a new cheap Chinese-built AI tool proof that the Americans are losing the tech race? And why a well-known UK coffee company thinks it's got the brew to win over local coffee lovers? It's Wednesday, January the 29th. The escalating violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, fueled by the presence of Rwanda-backed M23 rebels, has drawn Pretoria now into a diplomatic and military crisis, with several South African peacekeepers killed and regional tensions ratcheting up. The South African government is now demanding that Rwanda withdraw its forces and cease support for the M23. I want to try and make some sense of what I think is a very complex situation. Darren Olufia is with me, defense analyst at the African Defense Review. Darren, firstly then, welcome and thank you. South African soldiers are dying in a conflict that many citizens here don't fully understand. So maybe the starting point here is, what exactly is our military's mandate in the DRC? Why are we involved?
Good morning. That's a good question. So first of all, I must make it clear that South Africa is there as part of two separate missions. First of all, there is part of the UN mission, MONUSCO, which we've been part of really since the start, the past 30 years. MONUSCO's mandate is really to help secure peace in the area, help prevent some of the armed groups from going larger, and in general to protect civilians. We've also separately sent a force as part of the SADC mission, SAMI DRC. This was deployed mostly over the past year, and this has a much more robust mandate. It's not really peacekeeping, it's at the very least peace enforcement, or even more than that, a wartime force authorized under the SADC Mutual Defense Pact. That force's mandate really is, it's in five parts. It's to support the DRC to neutralize these armed groups. It's to support them, by providing additional assistance and relief. It's to protect critical infrastructure in the area and to protect civilians. So the main base for SAMI DRC, there's actually two parts of it. The main base was near Sakia on the eastern side of it. Which was really meant to protect the route from Sakia to Goma. And there was also a base at the Goma airport. But yes, the main objective here really was to try to help prevent, as with MONUSCO, the taking over of Sakia and Goma.
Darren, how constrained are we by the mandate? How difficult would it be for South Africa to call it quits and pull out?
There's nothing in the mandate that would stop that. Obviously, this would have to be a discussion with SADC and with the DRC. In terms of the withdrawal, because this is a joint force. So that's not the issue. I think the politics of that are broadly around what it would do to South Africa's reputation and our foreign policy and diplomatic efforts. However, I think it's also really important to note that a withdrawal is currently not necessarily an option because there is no route to an orderly withdrawal without negotiating with M23 as well and possibly Rwanda too. Because the airport Goma is closed, there's controls it now, and of course the base at Sakia can't be relieved. So there's no ability to independently withdraw. The only way South Africa could currently get its troops out is to do so, basically in concert with M23 and Rwanda.
The death toll is around about 13, and there is growing concern now about our military's preparedness for this particular mission. Do you believe the SANDF was or is adequately equipped?
No, absolutely not. For years now, we've been pointing out the risks of the severe underfunding of the SANDF, along with an acceptance of, in many cases, poor leadership, inefficiencies, and whatnot. In effect, the SANDF has a peacekeeping mindset, overly so, and it has allowed too many of its conventional capabilities to degrade, such as the availability of aircraft. I mean, for example, back in 2013, when South Africa was very effective as part of the FIB and the UN force there, we could deploy 3 Red Hawks and 5 Oryxes. This time around, those aren't available. There are currently no airworthy Red Hawks. There's no airworthy C-130. There are very few airworthy Gripens because they're still recovering from the year-long grounding they had. Effectively, the SANDF's capacity to fight a conventional fight, rather than being a light infantry fight, has degraded substantially over the past 10 years and even more over the past 20 years. So it doesn't have the ability to rapidly reinforce its forces, doesn't have the ability to rapidly evacuate its forces, or doesn't have the ability to rapidly resupply its forces. It's currently dependent entirely on these civilian charters, which of course won't land under fire in certain areas. And beyond that, of course, the troops were only sent really as light infantry. They had not much in the way of counter drone equipment. They didn't have enough counter rocket artillery and mortar systems. They didn't have enough vehicles to allow them to be mobile enough to really dominate the area. So they were effectively deployed as a fairly static light infantry force, which isn't always needed in the area. And of course, as has been noted before, they had no support. They had no helicopters for either attack, combat, or for moving troops around, or for evacuating the wounded. So all the wounded at the Sake base, for example, can't be moved to any medical locations. So it's definitely not a properly equipped force. It's something we raised from the start, and I think it's really just awful that it wasn't considered.
It is a terrible tragedy. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm hearing that your assessment of the situation is an inability to sustain a prolonged engagement in the DRC, and that could yield further tragic consequences.
Yes, I think a key part of this is that the force was undersized with the belief that they could rely on the DRC military for most of the additional functions, such as air support, such as resupply, such as medical support, and all the rest. The moment the DRC military itself came under massive pressure and collapsed in that area, that fell away. The force should have been sized and planned for the abilities of South Africa and the rest of the SADC groups in it, so Tanzania and Malawi, to be able to independently sustain this force. That clearly isn't the case, and now we're sitting here with a very, very difficult situation. Essentially, South Africa is still trying to play as though it has the military of a decade ago, or a military of 20 years ago, and that's not the case anymore. The SANDF is now much less capable. We have less ability to deploy forces over longer ranges and keep them sustained there. And we haven't recognized that yet in our foreign policy.
As always, I appreciate the very forthright analysis. Darren Olivier, thank you very much indeed. Defense analyst at African Defense Review. I do appreciate this. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's motor industry might be at something of a crossroads. Rising foreign competition, particularly from subsidized imports and low-cost vehicle assembly, is putting a lot of pressure on local manufacturers. And Andrew Kirby, Chief Executive Officer of Toyota South Africa, has been vocal about the risks to the industry's long-term viability, warning that without urgent policy intervention, we could see significant job losses and a shrinking local manufacturing base. He joins me on the program. Andrew, a very warm welcome to you. So you've raised concerns about the viability of the motor industry in this country. How serious is it? What is your principal concern?
No, thank you, Jeremy, and good day to all the listeners. I think, first of all, this is not just a South African challenge. The automotive sector around the world is going through significant disruptions. There's geographical changes in supply and demands. We're seeing a lot of disruptors. There's a move towards electric vehicles. And that's impacting, on South Africa as well. So the main concerns I've, been trying to clarify this or crystallize it into 4 structural issues. When we designed and agreed on the master plan for the auto sector in late 2018, we'd agreed on a whole lot of aspirational targets, but we also set six pillars in place. Two of them were to really enable the growth of the industry and make a bigger contribution to the country. And the main one was optimizing the South African markets. We haven't really done anything about that. And I'm raising red flags saying, look, it's not 2025. We can't sit back and just think that the auto sector from a manufacturing point of view, which is a big GDP contributor, is just going to continue growing or even being sustainable. We could end up, if we're not careful, just being an import replacement market, meaning that the imports will just flood the market and we'll lose industrialization. So I'm a big proponent of using the auto sector as well to help to catalyze growth in industrialization and turn the country around. And there's a few things that I think we can do. And I think we really just need to accelerate the collaboration and the discussion and make some decisions. We really can't delay it anymore.
Let's talk about how that collaboration might work in just a moment. But you talk about the plan. But is there not also a case of local manufacturers failing to innovate fast enough to compete globally, particularly with the imports that are seemingly engulfing the market right now?
I'm not sure that's really the case. I think that, broadly speaking, most markets have transitioned to new energy vehicles, let's use that category, only with specific interventions from government. There's been no real cases where that's happened naturally, simply because the cost of the new technology is much higher than the existing technology. The only outlier is China. But China has very specific and substantial support for manufacturing of electric vehicles or new energy vehicles. So when they export to South Africa, they can do it at a very, very competitive price. So markets all over the world have recognized this and they put import duties on those vehicles. I'm not suggesting we do that, but I am suggesting we have an equal playing field. We need competition and it's very good for consumers and it's good for all of us. But how do we do that in a way that makes a smoother transition and helps to keep industrialization?
Andrew, if we are battling to compete on price with foreign imports, surely this is also a sign that the industry here's cost structures, so I'm talking about labor, energy, logistics, are simply too high.
That's true. That is true. And how we combat that is very, very complicated. Our labor costs have gone up dramatically. You know, we are a lot more expensive from a labor point of view than some of the other big emerging auto countries rather than Thailand, Mexico, etc. Obviously, energy costs have gone up. We all know about that. Transport and logistics, you know, we've got delays in the ports, an inefficient rail system. This is really having a big impact on us. We export about 70% of our total production. So we really need to be geared around having efficient transport and logistics to be competitive. I don't think this is an insurmountable challenge, but it's something we really need to tackle jointly.
You talk about more collaboration within the sector itself. How do you see that playing out? And is there a growing appetite for that collaboration, do you think?
I think there is. We're quite fortunate in that we have been working together very well as a sector. Under the leadership from the DTIC, the minister in the past, like Mr. Patel, but now Mr. Tao, is convening an ESC, so an executive oversight committee, where he gets labor, manufacturers, retailers, and government together to review these exact issues. So we're putting this on the table with Minister Tao, and we're really hoping we'll be able to engage quite constructively on the matter. But I am raising the concern that this needs to be done sooner than later.
And in that respect, Andrew, sooner rather than later, how much time then does the auto industry have in this country before things start to deteriorate even more?
Yeah, so quite frankly, we're already seeing the deterioration. We measure the imported sales, vehicle sales compared to locally produced sales. We measure the local content of the local manufacturers. Both are declining. So we're seeing early signs of that trending. And we have long lead times in the auto sector. You know, our model life cycles are 6 to 10 years. So I firmly believe that this needs to be done within the next 18 months.
And just a final one, the auto industry, as we know, is one of the country's largest employers. So if local production shrinks, if there's not that intervention, do you have a realistic forecast for job losses?
Yeah, I haven't done that correlation. Obviously, it all depends on how much it shrinks. I think we're taking a little bit of a different view to say we all need to make a contribution to creating new jobs. Yes, we have the potential of losing jobs, but what can we do to turn this around so that we can make a bigger contribution to creating more jobs? And I think the job opportunities are enormous. You know, in the master plan, we wanted to double employment. That's not a small ambition. Yes, the economic environment globally and in South Africa and in Africa is a little bit different to the assumptions we made in 2018. But I really think that over the next 5 to 7 years, we have the potential to increase the total employment in the auto sector by another 50%. If we look at the opportunities, let's not just look at the risks, let's look at the opportunities.
And in that respect, and very quickly, you can't be too focused on the status quo. You need to start leading the transition, for instance, to EV adoption, which we know has been slow in this country.
Yes, it has been, exactly. So we are in a situation where most of our exports is also exported to Europe. Europe has already implemented CAFE and ZEV, in the case of the UK, policies which require a certain number of vehicles to be sold for every internal combustion engine. So that's already impacting from January this year our exports to Europe. On the other hand, we don't have a market here in South Africa, so we need to really stimulate the market in South Africa so we have the scale of being able to make investments to supply South African market and support our export markets at the same time.
Andrew Kirby, thank you very much indeed for talking to me, Chief Executive Officer, Toyota South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, we've all become used to Chinese manufacturers providing a lot of goods at a much cheaper rates than the rest of the world can. But I think it's safe to say that no Chinese product has ever caused as big a commotion as the newly released AI tool called DeepSeek. Well, what is it? It's a Chinese-made artificial intelligence model that costs a fraction of the price of similar models like OpenAI. And I'm reading that the key to the low price is less advanced chips. And because it needs less chips, it's caused a massive market crash in the U.S. chip market. The behemoth NVIDIA, for instance, recording its biggest one-day loss in U.S. history. Wait for this figure, very close to $600 billion. So what does all of this mean, and are there lessons to be learned for countries and companies as the tech race really heats up? From Worldwide Works, tech commentator and writer Arthur Goldstuck, a very warm welcome. DeepSeek has been described as a game changer in AI. Maybe let's start off with you telling us what exactly sets it apart, if it does, from models like OpenAI's ChatGPT.
Hi, Jeremy. It's fascinating to see the fuss that it's caused and the reason for that fuss and the absurdity of some of that fuss. Essentially, it operates much the same way as ChatGPT. The paid version of ChatGPT, though, and this one is free. And that is really the first thing that sets it apart, that you can do in the free version of DeepSeek, which generally is everyone's experience of DeepSeek, what you need to pay OpenAI if you want to achieve in ChatGPT. So for the ordinary person, that's the big takeaway. I, for example, tried to upload a PowerPoint presentation. And well, I didn't try. I asked it if I could, and it said, sure, go ahead. And I asked it then to write a press release out of that PowerPoint presentation because it contained specs of a new device. Mm. And it did as good a job as any PR writer that tends to write about these things. So bad news for public relations professionals, but fantastic news for anyone who wants to get more productivity out of their lives. So that's as far as the ordinary person is concerned. As far as the American AI industry is concerned, the fact that it cost $5.6 million to build this compared to OpenAI spending $6 billion to develop ChatGPT has frightened the Americans, but not quite for the reasons that you would think. You would assume that while China has caught up, the Americans are going to be terrified. Now they're going to ban DeepSeek. No, the reason is because investors into AI companies in the United States suddenly realize that they've been pouring money down a black hole. And you see them frothing at the mouth, claiming this is the Chinese Communist Party psychological warfare, trying to make the Americans almost give up in the AI arms race. So that's one of the narratives that's been going. The other, as you said, is that the requirement to build AI suddenly is not these mega advanced chips. But the truth of the matter is that the more people use even DeepSeek and its low-level demand on computer chips, the more DeepSeek will need to invest in more advanced and more powerful AI chips. So I think what this is going to spark is an even greater demand for chips that are capable of high-level AI performance.
It's interesting, Arthur, that you say the propaganda war has already started, and I guess that was to be expected. But did this development and the launch take people by surprise?
It did, but it shouldn't have, because DeepSeek has been publishing academic papers for a while now. They haven't kept it secret. If you were following the evolution of their model and of Chinese models in general, you'd have expected some kind of breakthrough from China. In fact, in my book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to AI, I describe the growth curve of AI academic papers coming out of China versus those coming out of America. And not just any old AI paper, but those that are in the top 1% of referenced academic papers in the world. And it showed that in the far distant future, like 2025, Chinese academics would overtake American academics in their output of top 1% ranked papers on AI. And suddenly 2025 is here, and suddenly everyone is shocked. They shouldn't have been, because this has been about 5 or 6 years coming.
Arthur, does this development then, in your opinion, signal a shift in the balance of power in the so-called AI arms race? Is it going to give China an edge now, in spite of threatened Western sanctions and also potential chip export bans?
It does create a shift, but not in terms of giving China an edge, rather taking the edge off the American onslaught on global tech, because the U.S. trade policy and foreign policy has kind of combined into a geopolitical war against China to prevent China from getting access to advanced technology. Well, guess what? China is capable of making advanced technology themselves. So what it's really doing is evening out the playing field rather than giving one side an edge over the other.
So finally then, what's the next big move? Are companies like OpenAI and Google going to adapt and compete on cost, or are they going to double down on premium AI models?
I think their investors are going to force them to look at more cost-effective ways of developing AI models. They're going to balk at these demands for billions or even tens of billions of dollars being thrown into the next models. Sam Altman made a massive impact when he said that OpenAI will try to raise $1 trillion for its next models. And the investors are now going to say, oh, wait a minute, what are you smoking? Because look at what the Chinese are able to do with a few million dollars. So that's going to shift the trajectory of venture capital going into AI, certainly from a point of view of the large language models. AI chips are a whole different story. And the overreaction by the market, which sent NVIDIA plunging, was quite absurd and created an incredible buying opportunity for NVIDIA shares.
Arthur Goldstuck from Worldwide Works, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate this.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africans are about to experience the world-famous Pret A Manger as the British food and coffee brand makes its entrance into the country. The first two stores will open this year at Melrose Arch and The Zone in Rosebank, bringing freshly made food and organic coffee to local customers. The Melrose Arch outlet opens on February the 14th, Valentine's Day. Pret A Manger has built a loyal following. It's got over 650 stores in 18 countries, and now through a partnership with Johannesburg based Milat Group, the brand is ready to introduce its signature fresh meals and beverages to this market. And with me now is the Chief Executive, Pano Krastau. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. I don't need to tell you that South Africa's food and coffee market is super competitive. Great brand to enter the country, but the critics might say it's a bit late.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the food scene in South Africa is fantastic. I think that with such a a vibrant young population, the PrEP brand has a great opportunity to the stall out in regards to high quality fresh food and also the culture that we have. I think that, you know, my view is it's never too late to come in and enter a market. But I think what's really important is having a clear your USP is of a, as a brand. So I think for us, we have fresh, high quality food. You know, our coffee is 100% organic, 100% Arabica beans, and 100%, you know, quality focus. So I think that South Africans, I think, really know and understand good quality food. And our sense is once they taste the PrEP offer, they'll see that too.
Paulo, PrEP the world over is well known for its ethical food sourcing. How is this going to work in the South African market, particularly in working with local suppliers?
Well, I think local sourcing for a fresh produce supply chain, which we have, is so important. I think that the more we can source locally, the better we stand, I think, in fresh, high quality produce. I think the great thing about South Africa, you have lots of great suppliers, a very advanced, mature fresh produce supply chain. So that has worked really well with us curating a menu with, I would say, our highest percentage of local sourcing ever in a new market entry.
I don't need to tell you, and you know about this a lot better than I do, that any restaurant or chain outlet lives or dies by its menu. It's got to make sure that it is catering effectively to local palates. Just as far as what you're introducing, will there be a locally inspired menu to cater to those tastes, or are you going to stick to the classic international offerings that are fairly well known, particularly to people who have traveled?
Well, I think the single most important thing when we come into a new country is being very thoughtful around the local consumers, you know, the flavor and taste palette of the consumers. And I think we've done that with South Africa as well. We have a local South African chef that we've been working with to curate a menu that is set to connect with the South Africans. You know, as an example, we'll have lots of chakalaka in the flavor profiles of some of our products. So I think this is, you know, you'll have some global classics like the classic cheddar and pickle that you will see in PrEP all across the world. But the localization of the menu is something that is very important.
And come on, Pano, just between the two of us, I'm sure you've sampled chakalaka. Do you like it?
I love it. I really do. And I think that, you know, what you'll see in a number of our products on the South Africa menu, that the spice profile is probably a little bit higher than in our European market. I personally do enjoy spicy food. So I think from that perspective, you know, we've spent a lot of time thinking through and getting feedback as well from local South Africans on the menu before we connect with our customers more broadly. So yes, I'm a big fan of chakalaka.
I look forward to traveling to the UK at some point and seeing chakalaka and Pret a Manger there. But that's a different conversation, Pano. Food is one thing, but service is the other. Pret is well known for its efficient and fast service. Your challenge is to make sure that the brand gives that same level of efficiency in South Africa.
Yeah, as you said, service and experience that we give to our customers is, alongside great tasty food, those two areas in particular are of high importance to us. And actually that comes from ensuring that you've got a great team and that they buy into our philosophy and our culture. And actually the partner buys into our philosophy and our culture, which I think with the Millet Group, they tick all of those boxes. So ensuring that we have people that have a passion and affinity for the brand and really enjoy hospitality and connecting with customers. So I think a combination of great engaging service, efficient service, but not efficient to the detriment of great experiences accompanied with fresh, great produce.
And Pano, the third leg of that triangle, I guess, is affordability. We have a fluctuating economy in South Africa. For many people, affordability is the key determinant. So where is Pret a Manger going to position itself in terms of pricing?
I think I would go one step further than affordability. For me, it's value for money. And ensuring that the consumers feel that when they purchase something at Pret, it's value for the quality that they're getting. I think that we have looked at the competition to ensure that we are competitive from a price perspective. Understanding that value for money is very important here, which I think we are seeing even more and more so across the world than ever with the macro challenges across the world. But I think ensuring that value equation is a combination of great service, a great price point for high quality food, a great experience when the customer walks in. And the combination of those should give a sense of great value for money.
And just a final one, the first two stores, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, are launching at Melrose Arch and also the Zone in Rosebank. I'm assuming that there would be plans to expand into other cities. And if so, which locations are next?
Well, there is a plan to open a number of other locations in Johannesburg this year. So hopefully looking to open about five locations. But I think the next obvious place after Johannesburg is Cape Town. So again, we see, you know, with the size of population, percentage of young people, that I think, you know, young people in the prep brand connect really well. And I think we are seeing our fastest growing segment are the 18 to 34 year olds across. I think that puts us in a great position. And I think we see a huge opportunity to grow and scale the brand up, but do it in a way that is, you know, sympathetic to doing it in a way of good quality. When we execute, I think sometimes brands can grow so fast that they drop the ball when it comes to quality and execution. So we want that healthy tension of growing a brand out, but at the same time, not doing it to the detriment of what we're trying to offer our customers.
Well, I'm going to leave you to your chakalaka and say thank you for talking to me. Pano Cristau, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Pret A Manger. It's opening in Johannesburg, the first store at Melrose Arch on the 14th of February. Pano, thank you very much indeed. And that's also our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.